a three-part series, and this part two and three will be in the coming weeks. Next week, we will have part two. We're generously hosted by Pam and David Lehman, which is at 5906 Berkeley Avenue. I was having an idea as I was trying to find this house. I don't know if I'm the only one who was driving around for a while. That perhaps, if we remember, in the beginning of the week, we could maybe put directions on the website or something like that. Because I was once at the Lehman's, that took me a while. But that might just be me. I might just be bad with self-navigation, which is something my wife has told me more than once. But we appreciate, and before I give, of course, dispense with the thank yous. And first I want to thank both Ellie Lassen and Pam Lehman, who are both involved in some of the coordinating aspects of setting up the lectures and the different locations. And in particular, obviously, for this evening, we want to thank Shlomo and Mindy Spetner for opening up their home to us. In particular, we want to thank Mindy, who was actually under the weather and upstairs, and in particular, to be able to host a nice gathering at her home, even when she's under the weather, so that it's very, very appreciated. And as all of you know, the Sputners are a very special family in our community, very much dedicated towards Harpatzas HaTorah and the study of Torah on many levels, and this is just the latest example of their graciousness and their ability to extend themselves on behalf of the community. I hope that this lecture, as well as the subsequent two, will be more or less approximately about an hour, maybe an hour and 10, 15 minutes or so. I'm happy to take questions in the middle, but one thing, this is actually the first time that I've actually done something like this. I have usually given in my past and immediate history two types of shiurim, or lectures. One are the one-shot deals, so you know you have an hour or an hour and a half or whatever the lecture is slated for to get it all in, and you budget your time that way. And then I've done other things, such as my Gemara shiur that I do during the week, my women's halacha shiur on Wednesdays, in which it's an ongoing thing. And whatever we don't cover one week, we'll cover the next week, and whatever we cover the next week, we'll cover the third week. So there was no... there's no pressure there to fit anything in particular in because we have an ongoing learning relationship. Here, where we're breaking it up specifically, not as a one-parter, a one-time share, but as a three-parter, so it was a little bit of a challenge for me just because of an experience to have a picture of the whole series and all of which I want to convey, and at the same time figure out a way to break that up into three parts. And what I have done, and again, I ask you to keep in mind, again, I'm sure it will come up and it will be echoed throughout the lecture, is that what we're doing now, again, I know that not everyone can commit to being at all three, although I'm certainly invited to at all three, but the honest truth is that you will get a large and important section and chunk, maybe the most important chunk today, but the truth is you will not get a full picture, not if I think of others, and certainly not of my own thoughts. Those are going to take the 3 weeks to fully develop. But what I've tried to do is lay the foundation in the sources that we'll study together tonight, and then hopefully develop the foundation over the next 2 weeks. As I've said in some of the printed literature, as well as I've mentioned in shul as we were discussing this program, that I really am motivated in a certain sense by two realities, two different thoughts and two different realities which inspired me to want to teach this entire lecture series in the first place. The first is, in a certain sense, contemporary or recent history or really current events, which is that we're all familiar with this immediate presidential election and all of the talk that went to happen before the election and certainly based on some of these exit polls after the election, of how important and how significant a part of our current cultural milieu is the discussion of what is referred to as moral value issues. And one of the major issues, which was clearly identified, if you can take the polling seriously, is that on the one hand, obviously for many Americans of a particular persuasion, moral values was considered a very significant issue, and there are certain political issues which come up which are clearly moral issues, whichever decision you make on them, but they're moral issues. And the Jewish community in particular reacted to, again, as a minority, we reacted in two apparently opposing ways to this general cultural reality, and that is that it seems like consistent patterns, historical patterns maintained. The overwhelming majority of Jews, about 3 out of 4, not necessarily for only these reasons, but largely according to the polling, ran away, and specifically were in fear, if not something less, than what we would call the Christian majority in those issues, and specifically you speak to many Jews who specifically wanted to vote in a way which clearly sent the signal they were uncomfortable with the moral values issue and discussion of many people, what's called the conservative right. At the same time, almost 3 out of 4, almost exact the inverse of the number, almost 70%, again, if the polls can be believed, almost 70% of Orthodox Jews actually voted for President Bush. And many Jews who were interviewed, including some of the organizations that represent us, such as the Orthodox Union and the Aguda, specifically have mentioned that part of the reason that they supported the president was because of his social agenda. Not despite of it, not instead of it, but because of it. So whichever side one comes down on, there's no question, this is something that's in the air. And this is something that should be discussed. And I think that, you know, as observant and as Torah-based Jews, so whenever we can, all of our discussions should be anchored in sources and in Torah. So that was one motivation for me in this topic. The other is relatively recent history, but clearly history. That is, this year marks more or less the 40th anniversary of the publication by Rabbi Soloveitchik of an essay called Confrontation. And it was specifically in light of this 40th anniversary that I felt that that should really anchor our entire discussion, and I really believe that studying that essay, as we will tonight, will not only enlighten us in and of itself, but will perhaps shed light, and again, this will not at all be developed tonight, this will be in the next 2 weeks, issues that relate to the specific issues that confronted Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1964, when he first published this essay of a Jewish-Christian dialogue, and frankly, that relates more to me than to any of you. In other words, when they speak about Jewish-Christian dialogue, they're speaking about rabbis and priests. They're not speaking about laity, friends, co-workers, or they're not even speaking about social conversations, cordial, going out for coffee or to the movies with the rabbi and the priest, right? That's like the beginning of every joke. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about formal discussions of theological nature, in which issues are discussed. And I want to address that a little bit, as well as, I hope, again, especially in the second and in the third lecture of our series, again, not necessarily to come to any specific concrete conclusions, although we may do a little bit of that, but to a certain extent give you a sense of, again, where I stand on a personal level, informed by my understanding of the sources, of a general milieu and a general mindset that we should have. Again, there may not be a presidential election for 4 years, but these are issues that confront us on a daily basis. Again, there's a certain culture war in America now. Everyone knows it. And the question is, where should we as Jews be on these kinds of issues? Even if you're not a rabbi, even if you're not a priest. The question is, you know, what should our role be, again, as a minority religion in this wonderful country of ours? The sources that I developed for you in this booklet tonight are essentially a cut and paste of the essay Confrontation. There's a little bit at the end that comes from some other things which we'll discuss at the end of tonight's lecture. But more or less, it's about approximately a 20-page essay. So we couldn't read it all, as much as I would love to. But I tried to do my best to cut and paste to give you the highlights of that essay. Subsequent lectures will also have probably similarly length source books, but those will be, all again, analysis of this essay, historical discussions, and people who have written in other articles where they discuss Rabbi Soloveitchik's opinion, etc. And then we will move on to other issues as well. But again, this being our foundation, I wanted to dedicate tonight's lecture to really studying this magnificent, brilliant, but really very challenging and at times elusive essay by Rabbi Soloveitchik. So before we start looking at some of the sources and the actual essay itself, let me give you, if I can, a very brief summary of the historical events. Now, as hard as it may be for you to believe, I actually wasn't around in 1964. So I really had to do some research to know what was going on, and many of you who actually were young adults, very, very young adults, and very young children in 1964, so you may not have been aware, again, it doesn't necessarily affect everyone's daily life, but you may remember some of the general spirit of the day, especially some of the older people in the crowd, more mature and wiser.
The Beatles came in the Ed Sullivan.
1964, the Beatles came in the Ed Sullivan show, exactly. So responding to the Beatles, are we selling? I don't yet know on record. He never told me if he was a fan of the Beatles. Yes.
1964, I believe, was the year of the Second Ecumenical Council.
This is exactly what I'm about to mention.
That's correct.
Exactly. So let me give you a little bit. Exactly. Let me give you a little bit of the background. In the early 1960s, and again, I don't propose to be a modern American, Jewish, or Christian historian. So I'm giving you I'm an amateur historian, but the little bit of research that I did, again, because it's important to understand the context. The early 1960s saw a tremendous ecumenical thrust, particularly out of the Vatican, particularly from the Catholic Church. And the truth is that much of what we're discussing applies equally to Protestants or evangelicals. It's not uniquely, at least not most of what we'll be discussing, uniquely associated to Catholics or Catholicism or the Pope or the Vatican. But historically, that was where the thrust was coming from in the 60s. And even though there was nothing yet, no statements at that point, everyone knew what was going on. And Pope John the 23rd, who was the Pope at the time, again, largely inspired in the aftermath of the Holocaust, a lot of the guilt that was, I think, rightly perceived that the Catholic Church had. Perhaps not as great as Professor Goldenhagen has written a book in which anything bad ever happened to Jews is the Church's fault. So that, especially in the Holocaust, I'm not sure, I wouldn't let the Nazis off so easily, personally. But there's no question that there's a certain amount of guilt. Eliezer Berkowitz has a famous essay in which he, I think, persuasively argues that point. And there was a certain feeling that basically this was what eventually became known as the Second Vatican Council, that they felt they needed to do chazara. They need to review what exactly do we believe. And when you do a review, sometimes a review comes with changes. Sometimes a review comes with tshuva. Sometimes it comes with repentance. And there was this major thrust, and in fact, the Soloveitchik was actually called on behalf of the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, and there was a request that he should designate certain people to come as observers, I assume in Italy, Rome, to the council. This was in 1961, 1962, and he refused. He said that he didn't think it was appropriate. He didn't send anybody. In anticipation and inspired and motivated by this whole movement and this meeting that was happening on the offices of the Vatican. Again, there was not yet an official statement by the Vatican, but everyone knew what was going on and what was anticipated. At a rabbinical conference of the RCA, which was known as the Midwinter Conference, it was in the first week of February of 1964, Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a keynote address. We articulated many of the ideas that we're going to study tonight. And then, subsequently, in the spring of 1964, in the RCA's intellectual Torah journal, which is called Tradition, look at the first page of your seat, you see I wrote the exact bibliographical reference to the essay in 23 pages. In 1964, in the spring of 1964, Rabbi Soloveitchik put that speech to writing, polished it, and it was published. Just as for those of the Soloveitchik buffs, this was the first English essay ever published. We know some of the other books or essays that he published which are more famous, but historically there was a rash of things that happened after this. But this was actually the first thing, interestingly enough, that he published in English. And was in this journal of Tradition, and it was, say, in the spring of 1964. At that actual conference, after Rabbi Soloveitchik had given his big speech, which he essentially articulated a certain position, which we're going to get to, the RCA itself, as a rabbinical body, adopted a statement, you know, the PR or policy statement, which embodying their leader's philosophy, which was the official statement of the RCA, which in the back page, and we'll see it on our source booklet tonight as well, of that tradition, they appended that statement. The two-paragraph statement, which essentially is the lemaisa, the practical resolution based on his speech. 2 years later, in 1966, all that's in 1964. In October, the end of October in 1965, the Vatican Council finally comes out. I think it was October 28, 1965, if my history is correct. They came out with their official statement. It's a fancy Latin word, I think, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Nostra Aetate, but I'm not sure if that's pronounced correctly. But there was an official statement about Judaism and the Jewish people, and essentially they made two major statements, essentially. One is that they revised, to a certain extent, and to what extent is a big question, but to a certain extent they revised their historical view of Jews and Judaism, what is known in the academic terms as supersessionism. In other words, we know that historically they have believed that the Jews were the chosen people, but that they, from Jesus, supersede us. They're supposed to then take over as the chosen people. And needless to say, that has caused a lot of friction between Jews and Christians over the millennia. How far they walked away from that age-old Catholic doctrine, Christian doctrine, is not clear 100% to everybody, but they definitely, at the very least, modified it and took a little bit of the sting off that idea that we're somehow have been replaced. That was one major statement they made. And the other, perhaps even more important practically, was they tried their best, and as you know, in recent years they've done even more, to repudiate anti-Semitism. They call it a sin, and it doesn't become a Christian, etc. in wake of these major statements, and again, no matter what one says about what the Jewish response should be, these are clearly major statements and developments in history of the Catholic Church. There was a major urge, not only to, as one writer wrote, not only to accept the invitation to go join the dialogue in the Vatican, but to run. And, as Werner Lichtenstein pointed out in an essay, which we probably will mention next week, one can't underestimate, especially in the 60s, the temptation to have your picture with the Pope on the front page of the New York Times. And there were a lot of rabbis, especially in the non-Orthodox world, who were running to accepting these invitations to the Vatican. And the question again got revisited, what will the Orthodox rabbinate do? Will you participate or not? So they came back to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and in 1966, he published then for a second time a more concrete statement, not long, not 20 pages, not with all the philosophy and everything that we're going to study tonight, but again, essentially reiterating in very concrete terms the basic principle that he had enunciated in the speech, the basic principle that the RCIA had adopted in 1964, and he reaffirmed that in 1966, and to a large extent, that is essentially, and again, we'll see exactly, there are nuances, but there was essentially a negative position, was essentially against any type of theological dialogue between Jews and Christians, and that has essentially remained the reality for the last 40 years, largely without any doubt because of his authority and his personality. Now, there have been individual Orthodox rabbis or scholars who have participated. Some of those have done so because they willfully ignored Rabbi Soloveitchik's position, and others, and this will be part of next week's lecture, have felt that either they have a touch, they have another explanation of what he really said, or as many held in last year at Boston College, in Boston, the University of Boston College, which is, of course, a Catholic university, they have a Center for Jewish-Christian Studies, and they had a whole symposium where they had some very well-known Jewish scholars, and some of whom had a whole essay, which we'll study, I hope, next week, where they claimed that what Soloveitchik said, that was only true in the 60s. But based on things that have happened even more recently, even he would have changed his mind, he was misunderstood, and therefore justifying the fact that they are very much involved in this kind of dialogue. So I don't want to be misrepresentative. There's no question that there are some Orthodox rabbis who advocate some of this dialogue and who even participate. But there's no question that for the overwhelming majority of Orthodox rabbis who have refused to participate, again, hopefully politely, but that doesn't always make it less uncomfortable. When you're invited to do something, you turn down an invitation, so that can be uncomfortable, especially when you're being invited by the Pope. So the Eine Ha'am, the whole world is, Eine Ha'olam is on us. Nevertheless, that has essentially the historical context, just to give you a sense of what we're going to study today.
Just one thing, didn't Vatican II also say that the Jews didn't kill Jesus?
I don't know.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. But as I say, it repudiated a lot of what, again, was believed to have led to so much of the anti-Semitism. But as I say, I'm not a Christian scholar, and we're not here to study Christian theology. We're here to study Torah. But it's important to know, and that's why I gave you this historical background, that, as I say, whether they went far enough, what did they say exactly, there's no question that they definitely took certain major steps. And again, the current Pope has done even more in the last few years. All that is undebatable. So if you turn your page to the source book, again, we have quite a few pages here, and this was me, again, I was cutting and pasting from 23 pages. So there's a lot here. And if anyone wants an original copy of the essay, absolutely. Yeah, this is real shameless. Anyone who, you're free to keep the source booklets. If you don't want them, I'm happy to take them after the lecture. But let's begin. The essay, structurally, literarily, is divided up into two parts. The first part is a literary and theoretical analysis of the creation of mankind from Sefer Bereishis. And the second part then becomes the practicum, the lemaisa, of how that informs his approach to this Jewish-Christian dialogue. So let's begin with an excerpt right here from the beginning. And you'll see there's two columns of sources. It's going all the way down on the left and all the way going down on the right. Again, I give you the pages in the original tradition volume. So page 5, the Rav begins. This is the opening paragraph of the essay. The biblical account of creation of man portrays him at three progressive levels. Humankind, humanity, Jews, non-Jews, all of humanity, says Rav Soloveitchik, developed, again, much of the development happened over one day, that first Friday that Adam was created. But he believes that there were three significant separate stages of the development of humanity. The The first level, he appears as a simple, natural being. What the Rav means by this, he says, is that he lives, but he's completely unaware of his environment around him, in what way he's different than his environment, and certainly what way that he is unique. Continuing over now to the next source, he has no need to leave a normative life and to find redemption and surrender to a higher moral will. There's no self-reflection, there's no sense of morality, there's no sense of being a commanded being or anything like that. He's living a life, and the life is no different. He's another one of, again, in the, I guess if you will, a lowercase a, he's another one of the animals in the garden. He's just Adam. But what makes Adam any different than any of the other animals that God created? At the first stage of creation, the answer is nothing. Not objectively, but from the perspective of man, there's no self-awareness of anything unique. He's just another one of the people. Now, it's interesting, in this excerpt in page 7, he points out that even though he seems to be talking about almost like a jungle man, that Adam was created, he wants to point out this attitude is not limited to someone who is uncultured, living in some rainforest somewhere, or on some tribe, either in ancient times, or even in certain parts of the world, even today, doesn't know anything, you know, running around, as a cannibal, or anything, one of these extreme types of things. It does mean those type of people. But he wants to point out, I think this is very powerful, he says, he's even talking not only about people in bygone times, he says, but even modern man. For confronted man is to be found not only, non-confronted man, not only in the cave or the jungle, but even in the seats of learning over halls of philosophers and artists. Non-confrontation is not necessarily restricted to our primitive existence, but applies to human existence at all times, no matter how cultured or sophisticated. In other words, and I've mentioned, for example, there was a famous philosopher, Bertrand Russell, famous philosopher, mathematician, and a logician, and a moralist, really. And he was a big ethical philosopher. I don't know the details, I'm not sure I want to know the details, but he was famous for living a less than moral or ethical life. And one of his students, they asked him, how could it be? Here you are, you're a philosopher of ethics, and yet you're doing X, Y, and Z. He said, I don't understand the question. And if I was a mathematician, would I have to live like a triangle? So that is the type of person that Rav Soloveitchik is referring to here. You could be sophisticated, you could be brilliant, you could be know the arts and everything, but this lack of a self-reflective, moral, singular, purposeful life, that is the first most basic stage of mankind, of humanity. He basically drives at, again, it's in this paragraph here on the other page 7 as well, it's a certain hedonistic approach to life, focused on basic human needs and basic human pleasures, all of which are still going to be true in the higher levels of mankind. The difference will be as mankind develops, they develop for other things. At this first stage, mankind knows nothing more than basic biological urges, needs, and desires. At the second level, natural man, again, we don't have I'm not going to have time to just, if we could just spend, we could spend an hour on one paragraph here, just appreciate the poetry. This is not prose, this is poetry. This is how beautiful and how sophisticated this is. And again, part of the reason why I could have easily taken one or two paragraphs and summarized a lot of this for you, but as some of the people in the shul, I mentioned this to Shal Shudis, I just came back from 2 days in Boston for studying with Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, Jacob Schachter at the Soloveitchik Institute. One of the things that Rabbi Schachter always encourages us is not only should we teach the Torah of the Rav, but let your members actually read and see the Torah of the Rav. Don't just summarize and give them over. Let them read the Torah, because the language, whether it's in the Hebrew, for those who can appreciate it, in the original Yiddish often, in particular, which I don't appreciate, unfortunately, and even in his English. This is someone who was born in Lithuania, White Russia, studying then in the University of Berlin, hadn't been an American. This is an English essay. This is not his. This is his fourth language. This is his English. It's just really stunning.
He also spoke fluent German.
Right. Fourth language. At the second level, natural man, moving straight forwards, comes suddenly to a stop, turns around and casts, as an outsider, a contemplative gaze upon his environment. He discovers an awesome and mysterious domain of things and events which is independent of, disobedient to him. In other words, the first level doesn't see himself as anything different than everything around him. He's just another part of the environment, but there's no difference between him and the environment. He's just a part of it. Now in the second stage, all of a sudden it hits him, I'm different. It's not, there's an I and a thou relationship. It's not the same as me. As he points out, it's disobedient. It's not always going to listen to me either. And then, as he says so beautifully, in the wake of this discovery, he discovers himself. Once he appreciates all of that he isn't the jungle, he isn't the Garden of Eden, he isn't the animals in the garden, with that appreciation, not only does he know the other, through that, he then discovers himself. Once that happens, he's now ready for some level of a relationship with God. And it's only there, said Rav Salman Chaik, that you have the Pasuk, Yitzhak Hashem, Hakim Al HaAdam. The Lord God commanded the man. Only once Adam realizes this self-awareness, only then is God ready to give him a command. With the birth of the norm, of command, of mitzvos, man becomes aware of a singularity, singularly human existence, which expresses itself in the dichotomous experience of being unfree, unrestricted, imperfect, and unredeemed, on the one hand, and at the same time being potentially powerful, great, and exalted, uniquely endowed, and capable of rising far above his environment in response to the moral challenge. In other words, what do we say? Ein ben chorin, Alamisha Osei Kutara. There's a certain paradox of human existence which exists to this very day, which is a very significant part of our religious philosophy, namely, who is the true free man? The one who lives the life of the divine command. So on the one hand, we're totally fettered. We have all these rules. You have to do this, you can't do this. And at the same time, that life of command, that life of Torah and mitzvos, endows us with such dignity that it's actually there where our true worth and true freedom becomes expressed. But it was only, again, at this stage when Adam realizes who he is, then he can be commanded. And when he's commanded, then he doesn't just realize that he's different than everything else. He realizes that on a meaningful level, he's superior. Because again, of all of the creations in the garden, who's the only one who has a relationship with God? Who's the only one who has commandments from God? And that, of course, is Adam. And again, this is, again, certainly a Jewish belief which emerges from the text of that biblical garden story, in which, again, Judaism feels very strongly, logically, to nurture, to take advantage, to be respectful of the environment around us. But at the same time, traditional Judaism has always articulated unequivocally that there is a superiority of man over the animal kingdom. I mean, right now, some of you may be following, there's this kashrus controversy. So I don't know the details, I didn't see the video, I don't need to see the video. Even if it would be a good shkita, I'd get nauseous. So if this was supposedly some particularly, but there's now in America and in Israel a big scandal. So I don't know anything about, and I'm not here to defend the shkita people or the supervising religious committee, because I hope that they did the right thing, but I can't know for sure. Yeah. One thing I can tell you, the one who's Kenegan, the people who have started the problem, the people for the ethical treatment of animals, PETA, so aside from the fact that they are a dangerous organization on many levels, literally, they have done terrorist activities, literally burning down labs and other things, but their whole worldview, their hashkafas ha'olam, is antithetical to a Jewish view. Again, as Jews, we should be particularly offended. They had very infamously, last year, they had these huge billboards up in different states in which they had a picture, I think it was chickens, and they spoke about how that's the Holocaust of the animals. They would say the ADL and the OU, everyone made a whole brouhaha, insensitive it was, and I think eventually they took the billboards down. But that's their mindset. Their mindset is that there is no difference between killing a chicken and killing a human being. So, again, for all I know, they're right in this case. For all I know, the shkita, what was going on in that slaughterhouse, is not right. I'm not here to defend that particular case.
I suggest you look at the video. I did look at the video, yeah. And I strongly recommend that you look at it.
Okay. Oh. I don't know if I will, but anyway. I don't know if I'll be able to get my hands on it. Let's leave it at that. No one please offer. Anyway, be that as it may, this is a digression. I apologize. Our hashkafas ha'olam, and this is what Rav Salman Chaik is referring to here, is that because of the way we were created with a neshama, with a soul, and because of our relationship with God as expressed in the norms and the commandments that we have, that creates a singular relationship. That mankind is the crown of creation. So what happens when all of a sudden Adam, when mankind realizes that we're not the same as our environment, that we're living in a foreign environment? Then, he says here, I'm moving over to the right-hand column, you have two choices. He can either play an active role as a subject knower, utilizing his great endowment, intellect, trying to gain a supremacy over the objective order. He can try to la'avda ula shamra. He can engage the world around him and hopefully control it in a productive and positive way. Or he can despair and succumb to the overpowering pressure of the objective outside and end in a mute resignation. He can just walk away. Be parsh. That's not me. I'm me. I worry about myself. So of course, the Torah commanded man to choose the first alternative, to exercise his authority as an intelligent being whose task consists in engaging the objective order in a cognitive contest. That is, again, what Rosalvichik and other essays refers to as the divine mandate that Adam was given of la'avda ulashamra. What was his role in the garden? To work it, to till it, and to watch it. We have responsibilities towards the outside world, but ultimately our goal is to master the outside world. Rosalvichik, very famous when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, Soloveitchik felt that not only was this a great scientific moment in the history of mankind, he felt that this was a watershed religious moment in the history of mankind because it reflected a new stage in humanity's ability to fulfill the divine mandate of La'avda u'lashamra. Every scientific discovery, he felt, was a fulfillment, even if it was incidental, of this religious mandate of conquering and controlling the world. And again, it's just worth noting that there were other contemporary great rabbinic leaders in his day who did not see it that way. There were some who were very cautious. What, do we have any business up there with God? Again, I just like to point out that I'm not going to tell you who this great rabbinic leader was because it really was great. But it always struck me as fascinating because that seemed to be the machlokes between Neil Armstrong and the cosmonaut. Because the cosmonaut famously, right, was an atheist, was from Russia. So he, one of the first things he says when he eventually orbited also and got into space, so it's famous to tell you at the Air and Space Museum, right, that he then says back to Mission Control in Moscow, wherever it is, I'm here, and guess what? I don't see God. It's one of the first things he said when he got up into space. Look, see, God's not here, right? We've somehow shown that it doesn't exist. Whereas Neil Armstrong, who was actually a very religious Christian, he spoke about it, first of all, how being there, how he saw the face of God, in the sense of looking and seeing how small Earth was in the universe, how inspired he was. And then when he went to visit the Kotel, you know, he went to see the Southern Wall excavations. Last year, 2 years ago, before I came to Shomri, right after Purim time, my wife and I went to Israel, and we took a private tour. You know, you're looking at the Kotel, that's the Western Wall. But if you swim over to the right, that's the Southern Wall excavations. And you see, from there, you see they've uncovered the steps that actually people used to walk up to. Right? Well, we're looking at the Kotel coming up from where Yeshivat HaKotel is near David. That's where the Kohanim used to come down to go to the Beis HaMikdash, to go to the temple. But the Southern Wall, apparently the average Joe and Judy Jew, if you had to come to the temple, for whatever reason, you went through those steps, that Southern Temple excavation. It's only recently been open for the public. But I'm not sure how many years ago this goes back. Neil Armstrong went to visit the Holy Land as a religious Christian, went to make a pilgrimage. And because he was such a famous celebrity, the archaeological people in Israel arranged for a special sneak preview. They took him to these steps, these new excavations. And when my wife and I went on this tour, one of our tour guides, I think was part of that excavation, told us that he'll never forget that Neil Armstrong is there, and he's standing on the steps, and he looks and says, you know, for me, this step that I just took is more significant than that step on the moon. Because that was seeing God's universe, but this is seeing where God's chosen people were. So Neil Armstrong was that kind of a person. I'm convinced that it was Siyata Nishmaya that he was the one. He was the one. It's such a religious mensch. So Rosalvichik held like Neil Armstrong. He held that there was something religiously dignifying in terms of humanity's constant striving for the stars and controlling the world, and all of that was part of the dignity of this second level of mankind. Soloveitchik actually uses this idea to explain a very beautiful idea, and I've actually cut and pasted some of the psukim from the Chumash to show you what he does and why he needs to do it. Many of you may be familiar that one of the difficulties in the whole creation story is that it seems to be repetitive. The first two chapters of Genesis, the first two parakim of Bereishis, are essentially repetitive. And this was most notably pointed out by none other than the biblical scholars who have, for now over 100 years or so, have used that as their proof that the Torah, the Bible, is not divinely written. And in fact, is a patchwork, this is the documentary hypothesis, of multiple authors. And one of their proofs is, after all, what must be that one of the authors had one creation of man, that's Perek Aleph, that's the first chapter, and another author had a different creation of man story, and that's Perek Beis. And for years, this has been a staple of biblical criticism. So it was interesting. Rav Soloveitchik, even though he was perhaps uniquely qualified of modern great Rabbanim to confront and to debate, with one exception, to the best of my knowledge or anybody else's knowledge that I've ever spoken to, he never related to it. He discussed other philosophical issues. That was not his issue. And other great Rabbanim in Europe, or Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, and there have been others who have tried to, from the traditionalist perspective, counter and debate the proofs and the arguments of the biblical critics. But the one classic example where Rav Soloveitchik does address it is he has a famous essay in which he explains these two creations of man. So that most famously is known in his essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. I alluded to that when I spoke about that essay on Rosh Hashanah. The Shiri speaks about what he called there Adam 1 and Adam 2. That's not for now. We'll maybe have another lecture series. We'll discuss that. But here also he alludes to, again, in a different way. I think this is not repeated in The Lonely Man of Faith. I think this is unique to this essay of confrontation, where he points out another problem. Because if you look at two psukim here, Parak Beis, Pasuk Ches, and then five psukim later, that's chapter 2, verse 8, and then Parak Beis, Pasuk Tesvah, verse 15. Seven psukim later, you have almost two identical psukim. The first pasuk says, Vayita Hashem Elokim Gan, Me'eden Mikadem, V'yasam Shem Esa Adam Asher Yatzar. That God planted this Garden of Eden, and he placed in the garden Adam, mankind, who he had created. Then if you look seven psukim later, what does Hashem say? Vayikach Hashem Elokim es ha'adam, God takes the man, vayinachehu b'gan Eden, he places him in the garden, la'avda, this is the verse I alluded to before, la'avda, to work it, u'lashamra, and to guard it, and to preserve it. On the one hand, it looks like two identical psukim. They're not really saying anything different. On the other hand, Rabbi Soloveitchik points out that there's two differences in the second pasuk from the first. What are the two differences? Anyone notice? Which one? Two different things are called out. Which verb? Vayikach. Very good. So the first thing he points out is that in the second verse, you have God placing. Placing, taking, vayikach, which is a very strong verb, Adam, and putting him into the garden. And what do you have? Someone else called that. What's the other difference? The conclusion of the pasuk. In the first version, you don't have Adam being told to do anything in the garden. In the second pasuk, seven verses later, not only is he put in the garden in a way that it does not seem to be from the first verse, but secondly, he's also then told, he's given a command. What is he supposed to do in the garden? So the Rav says here in the excerpt right below that this is, these two psukim, this contrast, that is highlighting this transition between level 1 and level 2. The verb ayikach signifies that God removed man from one dimension and thrust him into another. In other words, the first pasuk ches is the first level of mankind. Ayikach, and he took Adam, and now he is thrust into the second level of what he calls the confronted existence. What did we say? What's the significance of being at that second level of existence? Now you can have a relationship with God. And how is the relationship with God reflected? In the divine norm. You can have a mitzvah. You can be commanded. And that's why it's only in the second pasuk do you have the la'avda u'lashamra, the divine imperative burst forth out of infinity and overpowered finite man.
What's the source that there is, that there existed level one?
Think his own brilliant mind. Not sure.
What I'm saying is there any specific God?
I'm not sure. Yep, I can get you the original of the essay. You can take a look at it. I don't remember pointing that out. Yes?
I'm intrigued here by the fact that he mistranslates the Hebrew and he does it twice. Because the Hebrew says, Ve'etzav Hashem Elokim al ba'adam. Al-Adam doesn't, it's not Et-Adam, it's Al-Adam. Al-Adam means concerning man, not the commanded man.
But we know that he wasn't talking to anybody else, right? He was talking to Adam.
Okay, that's interpreted. But still.
Okay. Let's move on. We have a lot to cover. So there's a third level. The third level is what we're waiting for. The third level is you and me. What's the third level? Now, not only does Adam realize that he's not one with nature, he's independent of nature, but more than that, Now he doesn't have only a confrontation with, right? What Adam has a confrontation with nature, so he can look at nature, but nature doesn't look back. He can talk to nature, but nature's not going to talk back. What changes? Women are created. No, I mean, serious. That's true. I didn't write the book. Only at this time, it is not the confrontation of a subject who gazes with a sense of superiority at the object beneath him, but of two equal subjects, right? That's an important quote. Both lonely in their otherness and uniqueness, both opposed and rejected by an objective order, both craving for companionship. An aloof existence is transformed into a together existence. What is, of course, he alluding to? Adam is lonely, and God responds to him, Eseh lo ezer kenegdo. I will make for you, what we often translate as a helpmate. Or, of course, we know that is Chava, that is a wife. Two individuals lonely and helpless in their solitude meet, and the first community is formed. The community will only be born, however, through an act of communication. When Adam and Chava talk, we now have a communication. So what he points out, I'm going to summarize here, the next page is 15 and 16. What he points out here is something that's very significant. That when Adam and Chava finally talk, and when they have this relationship now that is created, when Chava herself, Eve, is created, not only were they united by the relationship and the communication, but when you talk with someone, so you can find out, again, in a very simplistic way, right, you go on a date. So what do you try to do on a date? You find out all the things you have in common. But even in a date that leads to a second date, let alone a date that leads to getting married eventually, the more you talk, the more you may find what you have in common, but the more you understand you have that's not in common. Communication is a two-way street. Not only do two people have to talk, but part of having a community and coming together with somebody is not only being bound to them by what you have in common, but the closer you become to them, paradoxically, the more you know about them, the more you realize how, as much as we are coming together as one, no one knows all the unique things that make such and such a man unique as his wife. And vice versa. The closer you get as one, the more you see what's unique and what's different about them. And the Rav points out that this is what's called a paradoxical experience. On the one hand, they come close. On the other hand, it's through that closeness in the communication that they realize, in fact, how different and how unique they are. And he sees in that that is hinted, that idea etymologically in the Ezer Kenegdo. Again, there's lots of different translations for what that means. But in this vein, he says it's an Ezer. On the one hand, we have common ground. We can help each other. We're an Ezer. On the other hand, we're always going to be different. Kenegdo. Two different people. So now he transitions from this, now, Adkan until now is essentially part one of the essay, which is this very beautiful drusha on the creation of man in Sefer Bereishis. He uses that to now transition, even though he's always a little bit vague. You'll never see in this whole essay the words Vatican II, you'll hear the word Pope. You won't even, I don't think, ever see the word Christianity or Catholic Church. But he then moves into the practical of, so how does this inform what was going on in 1964? And again, what eventually became, he was preemptive. It's an important lesson also for us. Too many times as a community we're reactive. Sometimes, again, with the right leaders, we should be preemptive. And as I say, he published this in 1964. It wasn't until October of 65 that the official statement came out from the church. Everyone knew what was going on, but I think he was very smart. He didn't want to wait to be defined by what they said and then he'd have to react to it. He was preemptive and got his statement out there. And you can be sure that the church knew about this statement. So he says the following. I'm now page 17 and 18. We have been burdened by a twofold task. In other words, Rabbi Sabalovsky, when he was giving his shir, I think it was the one at day 15 minute today, he was, or one of the shir, he gave so many, Baruch Hashem, I can't keep them all straight. But he was talking about how he was fast-forwarding through Jewish history. So we've now fast-forwarded through world human history from the one man and woman where they have this confrontation, husband and wife, they know what's common about them, they know what's different about them. So now we're ready, not leaving the world of humanity and Adam, who of course is the father of all humanity, to now how does this whole drush, how does it inform the role of Jews in the world? So he says, really, we have a twofold task, what he calls the double confrontation. This is a consistent theme, both in terms of the drush of the essay now, and then practically in terms of the lemaisa, what is going to be his practical position on interfaith dialogue. Says we are a double confrontation. On the one hand, we are human beings sharing destiny of Adam, of Adam, meaning all humanity, in his general encounter with nature. But at the same time, we are a specific minority people, a covenantal community which has preserved its identity under the most unfavorable conditions, confronted now, again, now he's alluding to, again, we know what's going on, even though for whatever reasons he doesn't come out and say it, confronted by another faith community. Of course, he means the Catholic Church. We believe we are the bearers of a double charismatic load, that of the dignity of man, on the one hand, meaning of all humanity, as well as the sanctity of the covenantal community, meaning particularly the Jewish tradition. This is a double mission that Jews have in the world. Like our forefather Jacob, in his famous bitter nocturnal struggle with the mysterious antagonist, the angel, the immense, this is this double idea. We're going to come back to Yaakov and Esav towards the end of the essay. He then takes a sidetrack, if you will, and again, he doesn't specify who he's talking about, but we can guess, and he takes a shot. He is critical of what he calls emancipated modern Jews. He says that they have made a critical mistake, that they have been trying for a long time to do away with this twofold responsibility. The westernized Jew maintains that it is impossible to engage in both confrontations, universal and covenantal. It's absurd to stand shoulder to shoulder with mankind, preoccupied with the cognitive technological gesture of the welfare of all, on the one hand, and to make an about-face the next instant in order to confront our comrades as a distinct, separate community. The Western Jew has concluded that we have to choose between these two encounters. We are either human beings, or we are Jews. Right? This, of course, is the famous line from the time of Mendelssohn in Germany. Right? You got to choose. You can be a Jew at home, but on the street, are you one of us, or are you not? So that decision has often been forced upon us in different parts of Jewish history. And in modern history, it hasn't been forced on us. But many Jews have chosen to make that choice. So the Rav responds so eloquently and forcefully that this is mistaken on two fronts. Number one, the first mistake is an assumption, and he points out generously, and he doesn't mean it condescendingly, that even this westernized, modernized Jew that he refers to, it's not that he's running away from being a Jew. He may be very traditional in some sense as a Jew. But he's made one critical mistake, and that is he doesn't realize that part of being Jewish identity is what he refers to as singularity and otherness. We were known, right, it was Avraham the Ivri. Right? We're known as the Ivri. And what does Ivri mean? Chazal tells us, Rashi tells us, what is Ivri? The whole world was on one side, and Avraham was on the other side, the other Ivri. Part of being a Jew means that there's a fundamental singularity. And he says this is the first mistake of the modernized Jew. And then he says, but the second mistake, and this is the one that's most relevant to us, is that even though he himself is the one who's saying, we're so unique, what they don't realize is even with that uniqueness, that isn't a stira, that isn't a contradiction with still being part of the brotherhood of man.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
In this dichotomy, I mean, the people who choose to only obey by the covenant and forget about their responsibility of being part of the human world.
Yes.
I mean, aren't they also choosing and
yes,
forgiving,
absolutely,
forgetting about one of their responsibilities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we will discuss that as it relates to practical issues in the next lectures. But again, the focus here of this essay, the community that he's referring to, that's not the ones who are making a mistake. In other words, the mistake that he's referring to are the Jews and the rabbis who are running for the church for the dialogue. So that's not the community you're referring to. You're referring to a different mistake, the opposite mistake, so to speak, of being exclusively singular.
Right, which he doesn't mention, and maybe it
correct
should be mentioned. You know, yes, not pushed only.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think there's no question he believes
just
it.
On one time,
but that's not the focus of the speech that he's giving, not mine. That wasn't the focus of his speech. But there's no question it's true, and we'll discuss where I think that has some practical echoes. So once he has come up with this idea, that on the one hand, again, so we'll leave aside now the moment so the people who he thinks are making a mistake. We can infer from the people who are making a mistake, so what does he believe? So he believes these two things. Again, we have this double existence. On the one hand, we're unique. We can't run away from that. At the same time, that uniqueness does not at all conflict with what our relationship should be and our responsibility should be towards the Jewish world.
Or the whole world?
I meant the whole world. I'm sorry. Thank you. Just to quickly read page 20. We have always considered ourselves an inseparable part of humanity. We're ever ready to accept the divine challenge of Milus Aretz v'Kivshuha. We have to be part of the world. We stand with civilized society shoulder to shoulder against all these things which are against us. But at the same time, as a charismatic faith community, we have to meet the challenge in confronting the general non-Jewish faith community. So what do we do? What do we do? So we're part of the world, but we're different. So we have to decide in each case which part are we going to express, our uniqueness or our universalistic impulse. So whatever you'll say about other questions, so now we need to know Tachlis. It's 1964, the church wants us to come dialogue. What do we do? So I saw a great joke. That just, you know, the Jews have always, in millennia, we've had this tension with the non-Jewish world, the Christian world. And just to give you, you know, it's a pretty heavy topic we're discussing, but I'll just put a little humor in it before we continue. And that is, I saw this, if I'm not mistaken, I think I got this one from a Rabbi Wahlberg drasha. I don't know if I've quoted one of those yet, but I get them. The jokes and the stories are fantastic. So one of the jokes that Rabbi Wahlberg mentioned, I think this is from him. I'll give him credit anyway, because I love him. So Rabbi Wahlberg said, told the following joke. I don't think it's an original of his, but B'Shem Omro. The joke B'Shem Omro is also going to be made via the Gula. Yeah. So the joke is as follows. There were these two Jews, I've moved the joke already. That's why I'm not Rabbi Wahlberg. There was a Jew, these two beggars sitting in Mexico City. One was wearing a big mug and David with a cup. The other was wearing a big cross with a cup.
It's who?
It's his joke.
It's Rabbi Bob.
Okay, it's a great one, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't blow it really yet, I think. So people are walking by and they look, right? Mexico is a very Christian country. They look at the guy with the mug and David. And like going out of their way, they give money to the guy with the cross. You know, 8 out of 10 times they walk by both of them. But the chutzpah, guy sitting in Mexico City with the mug and David? They don't give him, but they give right to the guy next to him, the guy with the cross. So eventually, a nice, caring, concerned fellow comes over to the guy with the mug and dove, and says, listen, I got to tell you, I don't think you're going to get that much money on the streets of Mexico City with a mug and dove. He says, you know, thank you for advice, and he walks away. Then he gives an elbow to the guy with the cross, and says, Maishi, you see this guy? He's telling us how to do our business. It was a plot, right? So I think there's profound wisdom in that joke. We're never exactly sure. We're with them. We're not with them. They try to help us. We're not sure if we don't want their help so much. So there's a lot going on in that joke. So what do we do? So page 21, the Rav says the following. It is self-evident that a confrontation of the two faith communities is only possible if it's accompanied by a clear assurance that both parties will enjoy equal rights and full religious freedom. While debating whether or not to absolve the community of the few of some mythical guilt, what is he referring to? That finally, this is what asked me before, that they're going to discuss, should we be forgiven for deicide, for killing Jesus? What he refers to as a mythical guilt, right? Don't tell that to what's-his-name, the movie. Mm-hmm. Mel Gibson. The community of the few of some mythical guilt, and completely ignoring its own historical responsibility for the suffering and martyrdom so frequently recorded in the annals of history of the few, the weak, and the persecuted. They spent all this time worrying about whether we killed Jesus. Getting the millions of Jews, particularly in the Crusades, but not limited to the Crusades, died literally at the cross. In light of all this, we can only even think about talking with them, he says, under four conditions. What are the four conditions? First, we must state on equivocal terms the following. We are a totally independent faith community. We do not revolve as a satellite in any orbit, nor are we related to any other faith community as brethren, even though separated. What he's alluding to here, and if you see the original, I cut out a lot of it, he discusses the whole concept of the Judeo-Christian ethic, or tradition. And he points out that if you want to speak in cultural or historical terms, there's a certain truth that is expressed by that phrase. But fundamentally, philosophically, theologically, he absolutely rejects and is very critical of that phrase. There is no such thing as Judeo-Christian. Christians have their things, and they should be proud of their values and their ethics and their mitzvahs, etc. But we have our own. We're not a Judeo-Christian. We're not, again, very often we're talked about as cousins of faith, they're related. That's, again, he's just in this little paragraph, after reading between the lines, he is totally rejecting, dismissing, and again, his other paragraphs, which I didn't include in this, which he points out again, culturally, maybe there's a certain sense, right? America is a culturally Judeo-Christian country. I don't have anything wrong with, I don't think there's anything wrong with that statement. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but I wouldn't be offended by the statement if it's true. But on a fundamental philosophical level, he says it can't be. We're not Judeo-Christian, we're not Muslim, no Christian, we're not any. There's no hyphen with us. We're Jews, and we believe in Judaism.
Nobody's talking about a Judeo-Christian society now anyway. It's all Christian America.
Okay, so that's what I said. Maybe it's not even true. Maybe it's a Christian country. But there's no question in the Western world they speak about the Judeo-Christian ethic. And again, on a cultural level, he didn't mind it, but fundamentally he thought it was inaccurate.
But at the same time, they acknowledge that their origin is from the Jews, as to before.
Good.
They
so he doesn't mind they if they can acknowledge anything they want. But we acknowledge no reliance, no relationship. I'm just going to try to move on, okay, because I want to make sure we can get as much covered in the next few minutes. That's number one. That's just the basics. Again, for him, there's nothing to talk about unless they realize are independent and autonomy. But yeah, don't turn over the page yet. The bottom of page 23 is perhaps the most famous part of the essay. You ask people who have read this essay what they remember, very often they're referring to the next few paragraphs. This is the most famous part of the essay. Basically, he wants to say the following. The world of faith, the word of faith, reflects the intimate, private, and paradoxically inexpressible cravings of the individual person and is linking up with his maker. It is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith. Let's stop there for a second. Until now, I have the next paragraph, but therefore. What he says here, again, is very subtle and it's very difficult language. You really have to study this and really hurry over it, as we would say. Agathosis. It's basically the idea, and again, there's questions on this. I don't want you to think I'm just giving you the essay. Next week, we'll discuss the questions on the essay. But he basically says the following. Judaism, as in any religious community, in any faith, is a unique experience, which he believes is fundamentally, it's impossible to communicate the basics and the intimate knowledge of that faith to anybody from another faith. And he says this, again, with great respect in the other direction as well. In other words, for him to have dialogue on a theological level is not only wrong sometimes, but it's completely impossible. It's completely unproductive and futile. Because whatever might be worth talking about can't be talked about. You come up with an example, you know. The Arizal is going to discuss with, I don't know if there's such a thing, a Christian mystic. It's not Shaykh. You're going to have, I don't know, some Hasidic Rebbe. He's going to explain what the, you know, Hislavus is, what our concept of religious ecstasy is, or, you know, we have a hard enough time sharing it with people of our own faith who don't have those same experiences. But he says, again, he's very respectful. He says they have their own faith, they have their own language, which we could never understand. But they could also never understand where we're coming from. And the therefore is, page 24, that the confrontation should therefore occur not at a theological, but at a mundane human level. There, all of us speak the universal language of modern man. As a matter of fact, our common interests lie not only in the realm of faith, but in all secular orders. Now, this is a very important point, which we'll get back to next week. But bottom line. So, Rabbi, what did he say? He said the following. Theological, religious dialogue, inappropriate, impossible, absolutely not. But what he refers to here as more social, moral, or what he calls the secular orders, so those type of areas, there absolutely can and should be dialogue. What's fascinating is he acknowledged fully, even in the next paragraph, if religious people are going to speak about universal moral issues, so the population crisis, sexual morality confronting American teenagers, we're going to get to, so that's a natural universal issue. So on the one hand, he just doesn't want to speak about theological issues. On the other hand, it sounds like those same things are okay. But he acknowledges a rabbi or a priest, for that matter, is not going to come to those issues as sociologists. We have no worth as sociologists, even if we want to think we're sociologists or psychologists or anthropologists. You know, it doesn't matter. Of course, we're going to come to those issues as religious, moral people. And again, to me, that's a foreshadow totally to the third lecture. When it comes to issues of separation of church and state and discussing issues of American politics in religious language as opposed to totally secular language, I think this point becomes very important. I'm not talking from a constitutional perspective. I'm a constitutional scholar. But I think from a philosophical perspective, it becomes very significant. As religious people, even though we can acknowledge that there's something that is somewhat a secular universal, at the same time, we can't and we shouldn't talk about those issues other than being informed by our own religious traditions. So he's walking the tightrope. And there are those, and again, we'll see this next week, who think he fell off the tightrope. But we'll hopefully defend him next week. But I just want to alert you that this is a very, very critical, a very critical idea.
He deals with the conservative and reform in the same way.
I don't want, yes, but very different topic, and one which I don't want to. I don't want to. Address.
He says two Jews can't talk about this either.
We'll discuss that next week. Also, very good, very good. I want to just, so to speak, to wrap this up. He says something final, which I want to point out, which is important, which is that he believes, and again, this I think is important, is that Jews should stay out of Christian tshuva. Jews telling Christians what they should believe, and you see this, if you listen to the ADL, or others, a lot, he finds to be totally inappropriate. Right, there was recently, right, there was this case of this, I'm going to be imprecise, forgive me in the words, this famous, I guess she was a nun, she died hundreds of years ago. And they want to, what's the word they want to give her? So the Jews are all upset about this. Again, I can't tell you for sure, but based on what I'm reading, what I understand, the Rav would have been totally upset at the Jews. It's none of our business. We shouldn't be telling them what to do. They'll do it, and then we can decide if we're happy about it or not. We shouldn't be telling them what to do. The idea of sending observers to this Vatican Council in Rome to look over their shoulders to make sure that, from our perspective, if they're doing enough tshuva, you know, they should be revising, you know, millennia-old Catholic theology to make us happy. If they'll do it, then we'll evaluate it afterwards. But we shouldn't be telling them what to believe. And again, even before I read this essay, it would sometimes rub me the wrong way. You'd be reading the newspaper and you'd hear certain, you know, Jewish leaders, you know, pontificating, no pun intended, about what the Catholics should believe. You know, I mentioned this once before, even when we speak with something else. I forget the quote of something from President Bush. This is, we're Jews. We don't necessarily have to believe that. But it's not our business to start telling him what they should believe. This comes up all the time. Again, perhaps the most controversial issue that many Christians believe, right, is that you don't believe in the salvation of Christ, you can't go to heaven. On one level, that offends me. It doesn't really offend me because I don't believe it. Right? I never understood why Jews are so offended by that unless they're worried that maybe the Christians are right. But if you really believe in your own religion, so I'm not sure why it bothers me that they have it. From a debating perspective, the Jewish position always comes off as more magnanimous. You don't have to be a Jew to go to heaven. But again, if we're just speaking about it honestly, first of all, it doesn't bother me because I don't believe it's true. But when Jews get up in public and are critical of non-Jews because that's what they believe, certainly when you talk about other people or politicians, first of all, don't blame the politician. Again, assuming he's being accurate, he's just telling them what his rabbi told him. So there's as a politician. You got to go to the church or whatever the politician believes. That's what's giving his theology. That's number one. Number two is, we need to tell them what to believe. We believe what we believe. We don't believe anything that they believe. So what's the difference if there's a particular part that excludes us more than the other? We shouldn't look over their shoulder and tell them what to believe. That's one of the philosophies here that the Rav tries to articulate. Now, I want to end by just telling you, you can read it on your own. The last part of this page, he develops two beautiful drushas. One, which is stunning, which is only found here, is when Yaakov is worried. Esav is chasing him, and Yaakov sends messengers to Esav, and he has him, you know, they ask, you know, Esav will ask him three questions. There's a beautiful drusha on those two questions, on those three questions, and he parallels that with a famous point, which I'll just repeat outside for those who have really good memories. 2 years ago, next Shabbos was the anniversary of my tryout. Right, Shabbos Chanukah, I was here. And in my speech about Yosef, I made reference to something. The ones who win, who remember, get a prize. Next week, we'll ask again, and everyone will get a prize. So, I mentioned something that the Rav says, which he mentions here in conversation as well, not only by Yaakov, but by Yaakov's grandfather, Avram. When Avram is negotiating with Ephron to buy the Maaseh HaMakpelah, where he can bury Sarah, he says, listen, don't worry about me. Ger the Sosha Vanochi. What does that mean? If you know, what do the words mean? It's a contradiction. A ger means I'm a stranger, and a toshav means I'm a citizen, I'm a resident. So the Rabbi asks, this is here in the right-hand column. How could you be both? Either you're a ger or you're a toshav. You can't be both. It's mutually exclusive. So, as we explained 2 years ago, Shabbos Hanukkah, quoting Soloveitchik here from this beautiful essay confrontation, says that's exactly the point. That is exactly what the Jew is. It's not a contradiction at all. A Jew wears two hats, right? Black and gray, white and straw. We wear two hats. On the one hand, we're a ger. We're totally different. We're Avram HaIvri. We're on one side, they're on the other side. We're our own unique religion, and we are not part of them. We are strangers. We are guests. We've been guests in other countries, and now we're guests here. We're strangers from the world. We're our own people. And at the same time, and that's not a contradiction, whichever country we find ourselves in, we are also a social. On issues that relate to everybody, place, taxes, war, whatever the issues are, you can imagine, we're Americans. We're Americans and we're Jews. The Jewish American, American Jew. I never figured out which one is supposed to go first. To me, it's almost picayune to start fighting about it. Point is, we're both. That's exactly the point. We're a ger and we're a tojim. Of course, they're not equal loyalties. There's a reason that Avram says ger v'soshav anachi. He says that one first. Or if you look at the Rav's analysis of Yaakov with Esav, the first two questions relate to why we're different. That has to come first. That's the predicate. But once we know how we're different and unique, then we can also be free to acknowledge what keeps us the same and what we have in common. So after this whole essay, 23 pages, who knows how long it took to actually give over the drasha, I'm sure it was a high drama, as well as his characteristic speaking style. So where does that leave us? So you can imagine, right, I'll be Havzi of the Rav, and you'll be all the rabbis at the convention, right? We're up in the Homelack, or some better hotel. Could there be such a thing? So they have this big conference. So if you had a conference, right, so look, you know, the rabbis come back from the conference, so what does the president want to know? What'd you do at the conference? Right, it's not enough to just, oh, we heard about Soloveitchik, give an essay. Okay, that's what we know he did. What did you do at the conference? So that's why when you go to conferences, you have to have motions. Then you have to vote on the motion after it was seconded. And you have to have first a plenary, and then you have to have committees and subcommittees to write up statements, which then be voted on by the committee and subcommittee, and then be... So what happened after all that said and done? What did the rabbis leave the conference with? They left the conference, they referred to the last page of the source sheet, the following statement. For the midwinter conference, February 3rd through 5th. Now, what I could never get straight, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't know anyone who could tell me. I couldn't find it in any written place. If I could meet someone who was at the conference, they could tell me, February 3rd, February 4th, February 5th. Which date did the Rav give the speech? I don't know. Which date did they come up with the statement? I don't know. They published a statement saying February 3rd through 5th. Maybe they worked on it all 3 days. What's the result of this whole speech that the Rav has just given? They're at the conference. The Rav just gave the dramatic keynote address. So they basically say the following. In recent years in the country, there's been a stress for mutual respect and understanding, and the current threat of secularism and materialism, the modern atheistic negation of religion and religious values, makes even more imperative a harmonious relationship among the faiths. The relationship, however, can only be of value if it will not be in conflict with the uniqueness of each religious community. Each religious community is endowed with an intrinsic dignity and metaphysical worth. Its historical experience, etc., can only be interpreted in terms of a full spiritual independence and freedom from any relatedness to another faith community. Any suggestion of the historical and meta-historical work of the faith community be viewed against the backdrop of another faith, etc. Again, this is where we're relating to this idea of Judeo-Christian, that we're somehow cousins. Okay, what's the whole purpose of the dialogue? To find all the things we have in common. According to the Rav, not only is that impossible, but it's also undesirable. Or it's only desirable, it's also impossible. We're not looking to identify and define ourselves by what we have in common. Even what we have in common is different. We're fundamentally unique, he says. Such an approach, if it would be, again, not following his rules, is unacceptable to any self-respecting faith community. Again, one can just start, you know, analyzing whether this was just diplomacy or genuine or not, but certainly in the language that they chose, it was very diplomatic. In other words, they are according the same self-worth and dignity to the others. We're not just saying it for us. We're saying it for everybody. To any self-respecting faith community that is proud of its past, vibrant and active in the present and determined to live on in the future, to continue serving God in its own individual way. It is the prayerful hope of the Rabbinical Council of America that all interreligious discussion activity will be defined by these dimensions. And then it quotes the Pasuk from Micha. It's very nice. And it's like flowery and poetic in its own right. The truth of the matter is that it doesn't tell you specifically what to do or what not to do. So this is February 1964. Almost, you know, a little over a year later, October 1965, the Vatican trip, they actually come out with a big statement. And then the question is, so now what do we do? So we'll see, I hope, next week, that Moshe Feinstein, who was not only a contemporary and a colleague of Salvation, he was also his cousin. In 1967, within 3 months, Moshe Feinstein wrote 2 tshuvas on this issue, and the second one was written, there was no question asked to him, but it's a letter that he sent to Rav Soloveitchik, all discussing this issue. Again, these are two great leaders of Orthodox Judaism. What do we do? Because even though maybe the Rav knew, it wasn't clear that all the Talmidim knew or were following what he wanted them to do. So that's 1967. We'll get to that next week, I hope. But if you look here also, there's a book called The Treasury of Tradition. Tradition is a journal that's been around over 40 years. A lot of great articles. So already in 1967, they put together a highlights, a treasury of tradition. And in that treasury of tradition in 1967, they published as one of the first pieces of that book, which I have in my office. I got it at a used book sale. Coffee stained and everything, but it's great. So I got it up in upstate New York, Monticello. You gotta go, you gotta buy books and conditioners. So you go to Monticello. So there, 1967, in this essay, they published, not only did they republish Confrontation. Again, the pages I gave you here are from the original. But there's different page numbers, but it's all the same essay in that second publication. But then they appended to it, if you look at this addendum, the following statement, again, not by the committee, but by Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, appeared in the Rabbinical Council record. That was their newsletter to their, you know, it's the union, the RCA, the Rabbi's Union. So they have newsletters. So in February 1966, again, it's a little over 2 years later after the original speech and essay, so he wrote one final time, and this is the last record we have from him personally, bottom line, Lemaisa, what should we do? And here, in very concrete, succinct terms, he finally really gets to the bottom line of what we should and shouldn't do, and he gives examples, which are really very fascinating. The Jewish religious tradition expresses itself in a fusion of the universalism, on the one hand, we're one with the world, but also a singularism. There's a common destiny, and there's a universal community, but we're also unique and different. As such, we are opposed to a philosophy of isolationism. This is the question you pointed out before. We're opposed to a philosophy of isolationism, or esotericism, in which we would see Jews living in a culturally closed society. And that's not the thrust of the essay, but this is a point that's worth noting. And again, those who know his general world outlook know that this is exactly how he felt. He used to say that perhaps the 14th animamin was that Jews can live and be vibrant in any society. The whole idea, again, when communities came to America, certain parts of the Orthodox community were trying to recreate the ghetto or the shtetl community and live in that way. As much as he may have respected them, was friendly with them, close to them, but fundamentally he disagreed. Because the whole attempt at that recreation was based on a premise that what we had there worked, and we can't have that same success in the new world, in the new America. And he felt, not only was it wrong, he thought it was profoundly an error. And he used to say that was the 14th animamen, that the Judaism can be vibrant in any part of the Golis, in any society. And this is what he's alluding to at the end of that first paragraph. But all of that is only on the one hand. We're part of the world, we should care, it's great. But on the other hand, we're a distinct faith community with a unique commitment, a single relationship, a specific way of life. In the areas of universal concern, therefore, bottom line, we welcome an exchange of ideas and impressions. However, in the areas of faith, religious law, doctrine, and ritual, Jews throughout the ages have been a community guided exclusively by distinctive concerns, ideals, and commitments. And these ideals must not be debated with others whose relationship to God has been molded by different historical events in different terms. And here, this is italics from the original. Discussion will in no way enhance or hallow these emotions. Klapei Pnim. These internal theological religious ideas, we're unique, we're different, we're not here to talk about those. We're therefore opposed to any public debate, but not just debate, dialogue or symposium concerning the doctrinal, dogmatic, or ritual aspects of our faith vis-a-vis similar aspects of another faith community. And now he gives examples. Right? You can't misunderstand this. We would therefore deem it improper to enter dialogues on such topics as, I'll just give you 2 examples, Judaic monotheism and the Christian idea of the Trinity, the Messianic idea in Judaism and Christianity, the Holy Ghost and prophetic inspiration, Isaiah and Christianity, the church and the synagogue, etc., etc. There cannot be mutual understanding considering these topics. Again, italics and original. for Jew and Christian will employ different categories and move within incommensurate frames of reference and evaluation. So that's all the big capital no exclamation point. But there is a second half, another part of the side of the coin, and with this we will conclude. When, however, we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication among the various faith communities is desirable and even essential. We are ready to enter into dialogue on such topic as war and peace, poverty, freedom, man's moral values, the threat of secularism, technology and human values, civil rights, etc., which revolve around religious, spiritual aspects of our civilization.
What about abortion?
This is 1964. But you can imagine that many of us are wishing we could ask him. I have my own opinions on it, but they're just mine. I don't know what he would say. At least I don't know for sure. Like everyone, I think I know what he would say. But I don't really know. Jewish rabbis and Christian clergymen cannot discuss sociocultural and moral problems as sociologists. I alluded to this before. Historians and cultural ethicists, or agnostic or secular categories. As men of God, again, he's using that category to refer to the rabbi and the priest. As men of God, our thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and terminology bear the imprint of a religious world outlook. We define ideas in religious categories, and we express our feelings in a peculiar language, which quite often is incomprehensible to the secularist. In other words, we have stuff in common. I think I mentioned this in other contexts, but there's a professor of law at Yale, a non-Jewish fellow, named Stephen Carter. He's a very, very prolific writer, somebody who I enjoy reading very much. And he made almost a throwaway comment in one of his books. I forget which one of the books it was, but I read it years ago and I never forgot it. He says, in today's day and age, he's talking about the rampant secularism, he says, all members of all religions are members of the same minority faith. They're religious. So this is something that, again, it's hard to know, I'm not a sociologist, how different we are in the year 2004 as opposed to 1964. My guess is it's gotten worse, but already it was bad then. And he's saying to his brothers, if you will, in the church, we have a common enemy that's called secularism. And finally, as he says here, in a word, even our dialogue at a socio-humanitarian level must inevitably be grounded in universal religious categories and values. However, these categories and values, even though religious in nature, biblical in origin, represent the universal and public, not the individual and private in religion. To repeat, this is how he ends, we are ready to discuss universal religious problems. We will resist any attempt to debate our private religious commitments. So this is a statement, again, you put it all together, 1964, 1966, 1965. This is where we were in the mid-60s. What has changed, how people reacted, scholars and otherwise, to this essay and the position espoused by Soloveitchik over the last 40 years, and in particular with recent attention given literally in the last year. There was a symposium in Boston College, was last year, in light of the election, etc., etc. That are issues which I hope to discuss next week, including perhaps a comparative study between Soloveitchik's position here, as well as Rav Moshe Feinstein's position as expounded in the Tshuva. And then hopefully, as I say, we'll take it to other topics from there. Thank you very, very much for coming. And I hope to be able to see you all next week.
Now I have to cancel my trip.
It's been taken.